headlines, a senior Ukrainian official says as many as 13,000 troops have been killed since the start of the war. Finland's prime minister says the war in Ukraine has exposed both European weaknesses and strategic mistakes dealing with Russia. Now, the British media say in some cities people are eating pet food and use radiators to heat food. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. As many as 13,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed since Russia began its war there in February. That is according to a senior advisor to the Ukrainian president. Mykhailo Polyak says the figure is based on official estimates from the general staff. He says they range from 10,000 to 13,000. The official was speaking with Ukraine's Channel 24. He said President Volodymyr Zelensky will make the official data public at the right time. Neither Russia nor Ukraine has announced exact figures of their casualties. Both sides are suspected to minimize their losses to avoid damaging the morale of their troops. In September, Russia said that it had lost almost 6,000 troops. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, tells us more about the Ukraine war casualties as well as the conditions of the soldiers fighting there.
Well, I can tell you those figures of 10 to 13,000 by the Ukrainians are not true. They're nowhere near true. It's an outright lie. The Ukrainian government is simply not a credible source of information. They have been downplaying their casualty figures in an extreme degree. To give a better indication, we can look at the head of the European Union that said a couple of days ago, Ursula von der Leyen, head of the European Union, she said in a televised statement, that over 100,000 Ukrainians have already been killed in the conflict. Some of these training routines that Ukrainians are being sent on in Germany and the UK, they've been trained from scratch with no military experience, to be sent in just a matter of weeks into frontline combat. And there's a matter of responsibility towards people who train these troops. Are they being trained well enough and sent into combat? Certainly, I've been to the front lines. Russian soldiers tell me the Ukrainians are just firing randomly. Whether they're being trained enough, also a former British soldier who's in Ukraine said that Ukrainians fire an exorbitant amount of ammunition without achieving much. So certainly the Ukrainians, without much military training, are being sent to the front line.
The Finnish Prime Minister says the war in Ukraine has exposed both the European weaknesses and strategic mistakes in dealing with Russia. She made what she called a brutally honest assessment in an interview with the Australian think tank during a visit to the country. She believes Europe is not strong enough right now to stand up to Russia alone. The Finnish Prime Minister is also critical of Europe's policy towards Russia over the past decades. She says the policy aimed to make close economic ties with Russia and buy energy from it to prevent a war. But she added that the approach was proved entirely wrong after the conflict began in Ukraine. European Union governments have agreed on a tentative price cap on Russian seaborne oil in an effort to limit Moscow's ability to finance its war in Ukraine. The price cap is set at $60 a barrel and includes a mechanism to keep the cap at 5% below the market price. The decision will take effect on December 5th. If it gets approval from all EU governments on Friday, the price cap will be reviewed in mid-January, and after that, every 2 months. That is to assess how it is functioning. The idea was initially promoted by the Group of Seven Nations, also known as the G7. The price cap is to replace a harsher EU outright ban on buying Russian seaborne crude. Russia has already warned that it would stop oil supply to any country applying a price cap on its oil exports. The Italian Parliament has passed a resolution authorizing the government to continue to help Ukraine, including via military aid, throughout 2023. This as an increasing number of Italians is advocating for peace, negotiations, and the Russian-Ukraine conflict.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials, and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including Centre-Left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
The British media say the skyrocketing cost of living is pushing people in some regions to eat pet food, while others try to heat food on a radiator. A charity based in Cardiff, the capital city of Wales, says struggling households do not just appear in areas long associated with poverty. It advised the government that its policy should focus on people, not places. The charity officials say people are not being paid enough to afford the essentials as the cost of living crisis is pushing prices way up. This comes as official data shows that the UK inflation has already risen to 41-year high of above 11%. The government continues to blame the war in Ukraine and the COVID pandemic as the main culprits in the economic downturn. The French President Emmanuel Macron has visited the U.S. with the purpose of boosting ties, but a thorny issue between the two sides has been the Inflation Reduction Act signed by President Biden. France is outraged at how the U.S. is subsidizing its own industries.
France and the United States are considered longtime allies with lots of cultural commonalities. But when it comes to trade, there are signs that the two longtime allies are heading for a confrontation. The French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting the United States on an official visit to boost ties. But during his trip there, Macron had some tough words directed against Washington for what he described as U.S. protectionism for its own industries. Emmanuel Macron is warning that the newly announced U.S. industrial subsidies could split the West. Macron arrived in Washington on Tuesday for his second state visit to the U.S. since taking office in 2017. French officials say Macron will confront President Joe Biden over the subsidies contained in the Inflation Reduction Act. The controversial act was signed by President Joe Biden back in August, and the Biden administration signed that with the Democratic-controlled Congress in a bid to boost U.S. domestic production and create more jobs there.
To a groundbreaking chips and science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
Well, things started really well off with Joe Biden. There was a lot of, you know, handshaking and shoulder rubbing. And we're in this together and extremely friendly relations until AUKUS. AUKUS, obviously, was lived in France like a major betrayal. And it was painful, and nobody tried to hide, you know, how feelings were hurt.
The controversial Inflation Reduction Act allocates billions of dollars to environmentally friendly industries with strong backing for American-made products, but European Union governments are crying foul and threatening to launch a trade war against the U.S. by subsidizing their own green sector.
France is not the only European nation to complain about the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Many European leaders have also complained about the legislative package. They say the package unfairly disadvantages non-American companies and would be a serious blow to their economies. The legislation could potentially be disastrous for car makers, especially in Germany and in France. Berlin and France have warned that if Washington does not scale back, they will introduce countermeasures against the United States. European leaders are mulling over the idea of a Buy European Act, just like the Americans. Germany, which is considered the EU's economic powerhouse, has also supported the French calls for more protection for European businesses and manufacturers. There are now talks of countermeasures similar to the U.S. scheme if Washington refuses to address key concerns. Brussels has made it clear that the U.S. legislation to subsidize its own businesses at the expense of its European partners represents a form of economic protectionism that undermines the rules of the World Trade Organization. The controversial act in the Biden administration comes after 4 years of rocky relations between the U.S. and Europe during the tenure of the former president, Donald Trump.
Well, during the Trump presidency, the European-American, the French-American relation was quite conflictual and difficult because in the White House was a president who didn't believe in alliance, who undermined NATO every step of the way, even talked about, you know, NATO being obsolete and there was, according to him, a need to move on. He stepped out of the climate agreement on climate. He stepped out of a negotiation on the Iran nuclear program. Everybody remembers that Emmanuel Macron tried to soften somehow Donald Trump, and that it didn't work out.
Furthermore, on the U.S.'s discriminatory policies against the EU are seen as particularly harmful at a time when the world faces an economic slowdown because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Ukraine war, and trade bottlenecks. It is now believed that the U.S. is using the war in Ukraine to its own advantage by imposing its will on the EU.
The first senior officials meeting for the Organization of Islamic Cooperation was held in the Pakistani capital in Islamabad. The meeting was aimed at paving the way for closer cooperation between the Islamic countries in the field of science and technology. Iran offered its valuable contribution to the OIC in a press meeting. Nasser Kazmi reports.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC Forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister Peyman Salehi told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arrange for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals. And at the moment, we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future. The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, Salam and welcome to our weekly episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we took up explanation of Surah Mumtahine, which means the woman tested, revealed in Medina regarding the examining of the faith of migrant women who renounce paganism and accept Islam. It has 13 ayahs and is number 60 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. Today, we complete it, and here are ayahs 7, 8, and 9.
عسى الله أن يجعل بينكم وبين الذين عاديتم منهم مودة والله قدير والله غفور رحيم لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم في الدين ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم إن الله يحب المقسطين إنما ينهاكم الله عن الذين قاتلوكم في الدين وأخرجوكم من دياركم وظاهروا على إخراجكم أن تولوهم ومن يتولهم فأولئك هم الظالمون.
It may be that Allah will bring about affection between you and those with whom you are at enmity. And Allah is all-powerful, and Allah is all-forgiving, all-merciful. Allah does not forbid you from dealing with kindness and justice with those polytheists who did not make war against you on account of religion and did not expel you from your homes. Indeed, Allah loves the just. Allah forbids you only in regard to those who made war against you on account of religion and expelled you from your homes and supported the polytheists of Mecca in your expulsion, that you make friends with them, and whoever makes friends with them, it is they who are the wrongdoers. If you might recall, last Friday in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said that it was not possible for a person to claim to be obedient to God and the Prophet, as well as those who are the enemies of faith and believers, even if they happen to be relatives. Bonds based upon religion take precedence over family bonds and are thus the deciding factor for one's salvation towards the bliss of paradise or falling to the bowels of hell. We also said that the words and deeds of the prophets are divine inspiration, and they are thus the practical exemplars or role model for all of us, especially for the believers. The ayahs that we recited to you tell the Muslims who had migrated from Mecca to Medina that your polytheist relatives of Mecca may embrace Islam in the near future, and that enmity will turn into friendship. God does not forbid the believers from having ties and doing good in a just manner with those non-Muslims who neither confronted Muslims nor drove them out of their homeland. He solely forbids you to refrain from befriending those who fought against you because of your faith and drove you out of your homeland or contributed to your being driven out, and whoever befriends them is a wrongdoer disobeying Allah's command. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the criterion for kindness or enmity between Muslims and others are religious teachings on whose basis non-Muslims who have not mistreated Muslims should be dealt with affection, while those who confronted the believers should be disavowed. Number two, if the enemies end their hostility, we should overlook their misbehavior of the past. Number three, Islam is the religion of justice even towards disbelievers. And number four, charity and good deeds should cover the needy disbelievers as well. Now let us listen to ayahs 10 and 11 of the same surah.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا جاءكم المؤمنات مهاجرات فامتحنوهن الله أعلم بإيمانهن فإن علمتموهن مؤمنات فلا ترجعوهن إلى الكفار لا هن حل لهم ولا هم يحلون لهن وآتوهم ما أنفقوا ولا جناح عليكم أن تنكحوهن إذا آتيتموهن أجورهن ولا تمسكوا بعصم الكوافر واسألوا ما أنفقتم وليسألوا ما أنفقوا ذلكم حكم الله يحكم بينكم والله عليم حكيم وإن فاتكم شيء من أزواجكم إلى الكفار فعاقبتم فآتوا الذين ذهبت أزواجهم مثل ما أنفقوا واتقوا الله الذي أنتم به مؤمنون.
Oh, you who have faith, when faithful women come to you as immigrants, test them. Allah knows best the state of their faith. Then, if you ascertain them to be genuinely faithful women, do not send them back to the faithless. They are not lawful for them, nor are they lawful for them, but give them what dowry they have spent for them. There is no sin upon you in marrying them when you have given them their dowries. Do not hold on to conjugal ties with faithless women. Demand from the infidels what you have spent as dowries, and let the faithless demand from you what they have spent as dowries. That is Allah's judgment. He judges between you, and Allah is all-knowing, all-wise. If anything of the dowries pertaining to your wives is not reclaimed from the faithless, and then you have your turn, then give to those whose wives have left them the like of what they have spent, and be wary of Allah in whom you have faith. These ayahs discuss conjugal relations of a couple when one of them becomes faithless while the other is faithful. If an immigrant woman seeks refuge with the Muslims, she should be examined, and in case her belief is ascertained, she should not be handed over to the disbelievers. Islam, however, is the faith of justice and neither leaves the immigrant woman on her own, nor ignores the right of the disbeliever husband, who should be reimbursed for what he had spent upon her. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, a husband cannot force the wife to follow his faith. Number two, conjugal life ends between a couple if either has become faithless. Number three, if an infidel woman claims to have become Muslim, her case ought to be thoroughly examined to ascertain the reason, whether it is sincerity or not more than mere passionate attachment to a Muslim man, or still a case of espionage. And number four, the rights of non-Muslims ought to be observed irrespective of their belief. We conclude this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment by presenting you the last two ayahs of Surah Mumtahine, 12 and 13.
Ya ayyuhan nabiy idha ja'aka al-mu'minatu yubay'unaka 'ala an la yushrikna billahi shay'an wa la yasriquna wa la yaznina wa la yaqtulna awladahun ولا يأتين ببهتان يفترينه بين أيديهن وأرجلهن ولا يعصينك في معروف فبايعهن واستغفر لهن الله إن الله غفور رحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا لا تتولوا قوما غضب الله عليهم قد يئسوا من الآخرة كما يئس الكفار من أصحاب القبور.
O Prophet, if faithful women come to you to take the oath of allegiance to you, pledging that they shall not ascribe any partners to Allah, that they shall not steal, nor commit adultery, nor kill their children, nor utter any slander that they may have intentionally fabricated, nor disobey you in what is right, then accept their allegiance and plead for them to Allah for forgiveness. Indeed, Allah is all forgiving, all merciful. O you who have faith, do not befriend the people at whom Allah is wrathful. They have despaired of the hereafter, just as the faithless have despaired of the occupants of the graves. These ayahs pertain to the faithless women who claimed to have accepted Islam at the peaceful surrender of Mecca to the Muslims. Certain conditions have to be met before accepting Islam, as is evident in the ayah itself, which forbids the wife to steal from her husband, commit adultery in his absence, abort the pregnancy, indulge in slander and several other evils, which should be cleansed from the society in order to make the Islamic environment sound and healthy. From these ayahs, we'll learn that, number one, in Islam, a woman is an independent person who has her own rights. And number two, cleansing the society from financial and sexual corruption sets the ground for a sound and healthy atmosphere, since many social ills stem from unbridled marital relations. Well, that marks the end of Surah Mumtahine. Next week, we will start explanation of Surah Saf. God bless upon you and goodbye.
Thank you. Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea's President Kim Jong-un has said that building the nuclear force is the most important cause, adding that the new ICBM clearly proved to the world that North Korea is a full-fledged nuclear power and can stand against the supremacy of the U.S. What are the reasons for his announcements, and how will the U.S. react hearing that, especially since Kim Jong-un has said that North Korean scientists have made a wonderful leap forward in technology for mounting nuclear warheads on ballistic missiles? Just a few of the topics and issues we'll be looking at in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Richard Becker, anti-war activist, joins us from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, also joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, first to you. The North Korean leader Kim Jong-un saying that his country aims to have the world's most powerful nuclear force. He said that while celebrating the launch of this new intercontinental ballistic missile at a ceremony which some were surprised to see his daughter. Not that it wasn't known how important nuclear weapons are to North Korea. Why do you think this is coming at this time and it being displayed in the way that it is?
Well, let's cast our minds back 4 years or so to the Donald Trump era, where actually Kim Jong-un and Trump were embracing each other, and actually there was a rapprochement going on. Trump had basically cut through all of the diplomatic nonsense that the State Department, it's almost like a firewall, really, with these bureaucrats at the deep state set up. And Trump had managed to cut through that in order to literally sit down with Kim Jong-un in North Korea and say, look, listen, you know, we can get along, we can start to trust each other from the presidential level down, you know, and that has all, it seems, been falling apart. But in the backdrop to all of this, I think we've got to just look at the nuclear weapons era after the Second World War, as the United States became initially the sole controller of nuclear weapons, and other countries then got on the nuclear bandwagon. Well, of course, it wasn't a bandwagon because they realized that this was the weapon of the future, and anybody who had this weapon would be able to intimidate, you know, not only other countries but their own population into going along with various plans to do with possible wars. If you go back to 1956, where the British were attacked in Egypt and the Americans refused to help us, I think that was the right thing to do, actually, because it was the end of the colonial era. But the Americans at that point really started to, on a plan for what was an attempt at world domination. And I think that we have to just be realistic about this. The Americans don't say this. They never say this in any official capacity.
Right.
But anyone that pays attention to world affairs knows that that's what the United States wants. And there's only one thing which will stop you being dominated by the United States, it seems. And other countries like Libya, etc., Iraq, etc., have realized this, and that is nuclear weapons are the only things the Americans understand. If you've got nuclear weapons, they won't attack you. But if you haven't, they may do, and at some point they probably will do. And so I think the Americans have actually made this situation for themselves by the combination of being the first major nuclear power, with Henry Kissinger putting the strategy forward to all this, and then also by having the unified command structure around the world, where the US military attempts to dominate every inch of the planet. This is, I think, what's created the reaction from Kim Jong-un and nothing else.
Well, taking a look at what our guest at Tony Gosling said, Richard Becker, first of all, let's take a look at what this intercontinental ballistic missile is that Kim Jong-un is so raving about. It's called the Hwasong-17, dubbed the monster missile, believed to be capable of reaching the U.S. mainland. Now, given the fact that they are now in possession of this, what do you think the U.S. is actually thinking, or how should it react? Or at this point, is the fact that North Korea is capable of having and making this type of intercontinental ballistic missile mean that it's not even interested in any negotiations on its missile capabilities?
Yes. So I do think that they are interested, very interested in negotiations, but there have to be real negotiations. In 2018, there was the meeting in Singapore, which your other guest referenced, which looked like it could move toward, the situation could move toward a breakthrough. But in Hanoi in 2019, that collapsed. The negotiations collapsed suddenly. And according to CNBC, the network here, it collapsed because Trump came into that meeting with a piece of paper and written in English and Korean and saying that North Korea should turn over its weapons and its weapons-grade fuel, to the United States. And that was it. That was the end of the agreement. Now, that was really, we believe, Bolton and Pompeo. Bolton's been a longtime advocate of exterminating North Korea altogether. He was asked once what his policy was in regard to North Korea, and he said, no North Korea. So you had those elements take over. And whereas in 2018, there was an agreement to limit or halt testing on the part of North Korea if there was also an end to the so-called war games, which aren't really war games at all, by the U.S. and South Korea simulating invasions of North Korea. And this year, they were back at a very high level. That was in August. And they openly stated, the U.S. commanders openly stated, that part of those military maneuvers, those war games, and you never know if they're games until they're over, but part of them was the assassination of Kim Jong-un, the leader of the country. The New York Times said he might have taken it personally. Well, no kidding. if the most powerful military in the world said, we're rehearsing to kill you, or to assassinate you and to destroy your government, well, of course you have to understand what that really means. So that's the reality of the situation, is that what was at one time appeared to be a promising steps toward normalization of relations, an end to the war. There has never been an end to the Korean War, the U.S.-Korea War. It's an armistice agreement. And the North Koreans very much want an end to this status of war. They want a peace agreement with the United States, and they want a lifting of the economic sanctions, which have done so much damage to North Korea and the people of North Korea, as they have to so many other countries in the world.
I'm going to ask you the same question, Tony Gosling. I mean, we could take a look at the previous attempts that were made by the U.S. And North Korea in terms of trying to reach some kind of a deal. But aren't we looking at a new landscape now? I mean, we're looking at a landscape wherein Russia is somewhat disconnected from the West, in a matter of speaking. They're not really interested in the West, and they're shifted, really aligning themselves with China. Do you think North Korea is still very much interested in wanting some kind of a deal with the U.S. in particular for sanctions to be lifted, given the fact that, I'm guessing that China is one way or another backing North Korea?
Well, it's a very important point, yes. I mean, in a way, North Korea is just a kind of policy maneuver of China that it can do at arm's length. So it can, you know, what they're doing through, I think, in North Korea is much of the things that the Chinese would like to say and like to do, but the Chinese are far, far more sensible, and they're trying to keep a good diplomatic relationship with the United States. But the U.S. has caused so much trouble for itself by throwing its weight around and trying to, well, I mean, what they've done is they've used this economic warfare for the last 20 years to bully and badger various countries around the world. And what's been the result? Well, it's meant that the U.S. is not trading with so many countries now that actually the U.S. economy itself is collapsing. And the Chinese are doing very well out of this. I mean, they've got a very well-oiled and they've got actually quite a well-organized state in China, whereas the state in the U.S. and much of Western Europe is starting to collapse. The big corporations taking over, the government, you know, basically finding it almost impossible to get in tax revenue because it's so weak. And so I think it's quite clear that, yes, the North Koreans do want to negotiate with the United States. But the thing is, as Vladimir Putin said, I think it was about 8 months, maybe a little bit longer ago now, the beginning of 2022, I heard him say something in one of his speeches along the lines of, well, the United States is not deal ready. This is a great expression because he's saying we can sit at the table with them all day, but we cannot actually get them to make a deal that they'll stick to. And they might even say something, but then they'll go away and they'll say, oh, we're very sorry, but our diplomats back in Washington have told us that we can't do this. So he's saying that to a certain extent, although they're always willing to sit down and talk to the United States, they're finding that they're basically banging their heads against a brick wall. And that is because the deep state in the US is in free fall, rather like the last days of Rome. When the Roman Empire was so corrupt on the inside that the various machines of diplomacy stopped working for the Romans. And, of course, their empire then stopped working. And I think we're seeing a similar sort of collapse with the US now. Many people would love to do deals with the United States, sensible, mature, adult deals, which would see all their people's successful growth of trade in the future, trusting relationships. Mm-hmm. But we've got a deep state in the US that doesn't want that to happen because it's afraid of its own position. You know, what we've seen is that, you know, there's various problems at the center of the US, not least of which has been revealed by the Epstein scandal. And these people are worried that if law and order breaks out in the international community, that the United States, the leaders of the deep state in the United States, the organized criminals, basically, may be just going to jail or worse, maybe being executed. So they're fighting a rear guard action, which is affecting their relationship with the entire world.
This is a very curious situation, Richard Becker, when you take a look at the landscape in that part of the world in terms of what the U.S. is doing. And my question to you is whether the U.S. does not want tensions to decrease. Now, when I say that, I mean the U.S. is busy trying to militarize. I shouldn't say trying to militarize the region. It's selling arms to the countries in that region, especially to the ones that are allied to it. Now, one of the main reasons it's doing that is, aside from North Korea, is the ultimate goal of China. Because we know, obviously, the U.S. has a focus on China. And it does not want tensions then to be reduced because it could continue with these arms sales like it did with Japan. Japan said that I'm going to quadruple my defense spending. I'm going to buy all these missiles, especially howitzers, I think, which reach deep inside mainland China. It wants to keep that at that level because it's going to somewhat be preparing not only itself but its allies in the region to confront China ultimately. Do you think that that's the correct way of looking at it?
Well, I think that there's no question that the pivot to Asia, as it was called, is aimed first and foremost at China. But North Korea also has an important role now, and the relations between them are strong, it appears, as they are between North Korea and Russia. And Russia and China, but particularly China, is the main target of the pivot to Asia and this huge buildup, which has seen vast deployment of U.S. military forces, increased military forces. There were already vast forces there in the Indo-Pac Command, as they call it, the Pacific Command. And this is an important factor in this. And the military buildup in Japan is also, it's also worth noting, Korea used to be, was for decades, a colony of Japan. And now the right wing and the militarists in Japan, they find it intolerable that they don't have nuclear weapons when their former colony does, North Korea being half of what their former colony was. And that's a big issue in Japan among the right wing. And if the as this process continues, the military buildup on the part of, and nuclear buildup on the part of Korea, the pressures inside Japan grow for Japan to become also a nuclear power. The U.S. does not want Japan to become a nuclear power. It wants Japan to continue to be subordinate to the United States. And Japan is occupied. The occupation of Japan has never ended since the end of World War II. Tens of thousands of troops are all over Japan and Okinawa, as well as other bases in the area, but particularly Japan and Okinawa are key bases for the U.S. Military strategy in regard to Asia and its strategy of domination of Asia and global domination.
That's a very good point that you're making there. Since you mentioned China and Russia, Tony Gosling, I'm looking at a couple of important points there on China. One of them, which involves Russia also, is that the U.S. says that both Russia and China have the ability to have leverage on North Korea to stop them from conducting these tests, and it wants to see Russia and China do that. It's not as if you've been hosting Russia and China in such a cordial, warm manner, you know, right. when you then come out and make a, I don't want to say demand, but asking both of them to do that. Why should Russia and China do that for the U.S.?
Well, they're not going to, I don't think, because actually what Kim Jong-un is doing is serving a very useful purpose, particularly for the Chinese. I mean, he is saber-rattling for the Chinese, I think, it's fair to say. The Chinese would much rather not be, you know, going for any confrontation. And obviously, at the moment, there are all sorts of domestic problems the Chinese have got to cope with demonstrations against the continued lockdowns and this sort of thing going on within China. It's serving, I think, a useful purpose, and it's very unlikely. When I say useful purpose, I mean countering the bullying of the United States, effectively, and saying, well, look, you know, if you can play at this game of making nuclear threats, so can we. And although the United States isn't necessarily making those on CNN, what it's doing is it's moving its forces closer to China, and it's surrounding China. It's threatening to blockade China, basically, by its military maneuvers. But I think that where the solutions might come to all of this, we need to look closely at, there are high-level connections between the United States and China, which very rarely get talked about. There was a very good discussion about all this recently by James Corbett and Whitney Webb, two very good freelance journalists, who I'm sure some of your viewers will know, at looking at the connections between the two. Now, this is a kind of deep state connection between the US and China. And so I think if there is going to be any dropping of these tensions, and of course, if that happens, that what we'll see is less saber-rattling from Kim Jong-un and less saber-rattling from the United States, maybe even some U.S. troops going home from places like Japan, we were just hearing about, and in other places in the Pacific. That's where this should start. But of course, there is also a very important party in all of this, and that is the arms lobby. The arms lobby are pushing so much of US policy. They are very, very close to, obviously, the military, the State Department, and the US government. And they are the people, I think, that are pushing all these saber-rattling and the tension, because they will simply make money out of any kind of conflict. Although, you know, many people think, well, we don't want a war. Why does anyone want a war? The arms lobby love wars. I hate to tell you, but they do, because they make a fantastic amount of money at it. And right. In the United States, they have the ear of Congress. They have the ear of President Biden. The sorts of fear-mongering that the arms lobby come out with, but, I'm afraid, is the talk of the president and other people that talking about China and North Korea as a big threat, actually pushing their armed forces closer to these countries. And that is actually the arms lobby speaking. It's not the democratic people of the United States by any means.
Well, but to what degree is this, U.S. military going to go, even though they're interested, as our guest there said, the arms lobby is interested in these conflicts when we're talking about nuclear conflicts? I mean, Richard Becker, taking a look at what's happening in Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia. So you have a nuclear armed country there that the U.S. and Russia have exchanged statements amongst each other, with Russia at least proposing the idea of perhaps the use of nuclear weapons, even though it has said on many occasions that it's not going to do that. Or when it comes to the case of North Korea, of which the U.S. has also, in reaction, for example, gone ahead and has its B-52 bombers, for example, flying over. Even China itself has nuclear bombs. And also looking at the region in the West Asia, or the Middle East, as some call it, its ally, Israel, that has nuclear bombs. I mean, these are tensions around the world involving nuclear weapons. And the common denominator here is the U.S.
That's right. And, you know, it's not that China wants to rule the world or North Korea wants to rule. That's not true. But it is true that the United States wants to rule the world. I mean, it's the policy, the national security strategy changed in 2018 to one of away from the war on terrorism, so-called, to major party competition or major party conflict. It's clear what that means. You know, and we have to remember when in the longer term context, that it was in February, I believe, of 2002 that Bush gave his infamous speech and the State of the Union, and it talked about the axis of evil. And it was a ridiculous speech, but very threatening to those who were the target, mainly the axis of evil being Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iran and Iraq had a war, an eight-year war with each other. They weren't exactly allies, and neither were allies of, they might have friendly relations, but not allies with North Korea. And then what happened? Iraq was destroyed. Its state destroyed, and it remains destroyed today by the U.S. And then we have Libya was persuaded to give up its weapons programs, turn them over to the U.S., and then Libya was destroyed. So it was after the destruction of Iraq and the second Iraq war, U.S.-Iraq war, that North Korea resolutely set out that we're going to have a nuclear program, we're going to have nuclear weapons. They had been doing research before, but that really triggered the decision to go forward, we believe. And that is understandable. If you can't be able to respond to your adversary and your adversary is threatening your existence, well, you have a big problem. And so, you know, I think that's the context we have to see this in, is that it has been, as you said, the common denominator being the U.S. and its vast nuclear weapons program. I should also add, North Korea probably has 40 nuclear weapons at this point, maybe a little bit more than that. They can develop 6 or 7 a year. The United States has over 6,000 nuclear weapons and can destroy the entire planet with its nuclear arsenal in case of war. And that's where the great threat comes from in terms of nuclear weapons and what they can do to humanity and to the world that we live in.
We're just fresh out of time. Tony Gosling, investigative journalist, thank you. Richard Becker, anti-war activist, Answer Coalition from San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until the next Spotlight, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio.